On the last episode of Modern Practice, we discussed the importance of mortality scores to healthcare organizations. We also examined our comprehensive mortality reduction program here at Vizient. Today, we'll continue our discussion. I'm your host, Dr. Tom Villanueva, Principal in Operations and Quality at Vizient and Practicing Internist. Amin, welcome back.
Thanks, Tom. Glad to be back with you.
So on the previous podcast, we broke down our comprehensive mortality reduction program into four work streams: the transfer center, palliative care and hospice care, mortality review, and documentation. So we've had our subject matter expert in CDI, Angeline Hunt, join us in a previous podcast. But I was wondering, can you share your perspective as a physician on the importance of documentation?
Documentation and coding, as I mentioned in the last session, really impacts what we call the expected values, whether it's mortality or whether it's length of stay or whether it's cost, whatever metric you're going to look at, making sure that we have the ICD-10 codes in the final coding summary that really will impact whatever metric we're going after is essential. So there's three pieces to the puzzle when we talk about documentation and coding. There's the physician, there's the clinical documentation specialist, and there is the coding department. So that clinical documentation specialist really serves as, say, kind of the middleman, the translator, so to speak, to translate what we write in the medical record as physicians to what the coders are going to code the final discharge document that goes out the door for billing purposes. So what we tend to write in the record, Tom, as you so eloquently always put it, is we write notes for other doctors. We don't write notes for the insurance companies. We don't write notes for CMS stars. We don't write notes for LeapFrog. We write notes to talk to one another and talk to our consultants. But that language doesn't really represent how sick our patients are. I'll give you an example, Tom. I was doing work at an academic medical center, and they had a really bad mortality index in their ranking. And one of the areas that really stood out was neurosurgery. And we all know neurosurgery patients are really sick. If you're in the hospital for a neurosurgical issue, chances are you've got a high relative expected mortality. So this organization's mortality was extremely out of proportion to the rest of the academic medical centers. And I met with the neurosurgical chief and I said, you know what, your patients don't have cerebral edema on the final coding summary, but all of the other academic medical centers whose patients are not doing well or really sick, they all have cerebral edema. And he looks at me and he says, all my patients have cerebral edema. And I said, but it's not in the record. He goes, well, I wrote midline shift. And I said to the neurosurgical chief, midline shift means something to me and you, but it doesn't mean anything to the coding department and it doesn't mean anything to the insurance companies. So that's really where the CDI specialist serving as that translator, so to speak, to help us understand that we need to document cerebral edema in the medical record and not midline shift.
This is not clinically intuitive to docs. It's just not. And thank you for always using my quote in that sense as well. It's just, we write notes for other doctors. But sometimes you and I have gotten some pushback where people say that because we think that a lot of work when it comes to documentation is necessary, that we're gaming the system. And that's just not the case, is it?
No, it's not gaming the system at all. It's putting our words into the right language that makes sense for the medical record and for the coding folks. So whether it's for reimbursement purposes, whether it's for quality purposes, whatever the case is, when ICD-9 went to ICD-10, the explosion of codes that are out there now, even non-physicians that are in the documentation and coding world still have to get education on a routine basis, on an annual basis to keep up with all the changes that occur. So if non-clinicians that specialize in documentation and coding have to keep up with this on a routine basis, imagine physicians that have never even had any education in this, have the knowledge to be able to document what they need to accurately flag how sick their patients are.
Do you think that lots of physicians know that coders or a large proportion of coders really don't have a clinical background?
No, not at all. I don't even think physicians, as I meet with physicians around the country, I don't think they even realize what the process is from when their patient goes home to how the chart makes it to the insurance company or how the chart makes it to CMS to be evaluated. I don't think physicians understand that process once the medical record leaves the hospital.
It's just hard enough keeping up with the medicine. So my next comment is done with the utmost of respect for my surgical colleagues, and I'm very sincere about that. But many of our surgical colleagues right now, Amin, are good at doing the procedure or some sometimes we use the term proceduralist. And the technical component of many of these procedures right now are very intricate and require unbelievable skills. But in acquiring their skills, many of our surgical colleagues lose the ability to treat or even understand chronic disease management. So is that why we tend to see a larger sometimes opportunity and documentation among our surgeons and affecting their mortality?
Yeah, you know, that's a good topic to bring up. When a surgeon is standing in an OR for 12 hours a day, the last thing that they need to be concerned about is making sure that the patient has their heart failure appropriately documented in the medical record. Mm-hmm. That's not their job. It really isn't. They're in the OR to do the procedures that they do. And we've seen around the country a lot more organizations moving to a co-management model, where a hospitalist or even a nurse practitioner is managing the chronic medical conditions and responsible for having that documentation in the medical record. So I think that as we move forward, we're seeing more and more the practice changing to where we have true co-management models. So let the medicine docs handle the medicine issues and let the surgical docs handle the surgical issues. And I think we will see more robust documentation in the medical record.
Yeah, I think it speaks to the opportunity that lies for if your hospitalist program isn't co-managing, you should seriously consider that.
Absolutely.
So let's move on to another work stream. Let's talk about the transfer center. And here's where I see a huge opportunity, particularly for our very large organizations, particularly academic medical centers, where they just have a culture, if you will, of accepting everyone.
Right. And you know, that's not uncommon. As an academic medical center, you're the last stop, right? So you naturally want to say yes to everything and you want to accept all patients. But at some point, we have to risk stratify what's coming through the door. There are certain patients that are going to be transferred to the academic medical center that truly need a higher level of care, that we can offer them something that some of the outlying organizations can't offer them. But on the flip side, there are patients that are being transferred to academic medical centers where there's nothing more that we can offer them, or there's no additional service that we can provide that's going to change the outcome or the course of care for that individual. It's unfortunate, but it's true in some cases. So when we look at that, we look at the data within the clinical database, and we see across the country, it's not uncommon that about 25% in some instances, maybe even 30% in some instances, of mortalities coming through the transfer center are occurring within the first 24 to 48 hours of the patient arriving to the hospital. What that tells us is that about a quarter of the patients that are coming in through the transfer center probably came to the organization and there was no additional service that was provided for the care of that patient that could have prevented that patient from expiring.
I think in the work that we're doing is having a recognition to have that discussion on what the expectations are in the transfer. I know that for many of the facilities requesting the transfer, they may feel that they don't have the resources to address, but we're not being very patient focused. And are we including the patient and the family on what those expectations are? Did they understand that there's a high likelihood that their family member may still pass away if that is the case, or even using some type of risk score, if you will?
Yeah, in my experience, I don't think that the patient's families are involved in the decision-making process, nor are they knowledgeable or educated that if they transfer the patient, the outcome may not change. I think that a lot of families have the expectation that they're being transferred to an academic medical center and everything's going to be fine. I think we have to set realistic expectations from the get-go, even before we start the transfer process, that yeah, we're going to transfer the patient, but there is a likelihood that the outcome may not change.
Yeah, I agree. Or even just having that real-time discussion. So we've actually worked with academic medical centers that have taken the stance of saying no when the patient has a high likelihood of passing away. And we also deal with the majority of the time of an academic medical center or a large facility that's uncomfortable with saying no because they're afraid of the ramifications of that. So say they do take the case. Is there an opportunity to place the patient, say, if the patient has a high risk, that you actually place them in observation first? And we've gotten some pushback that also, again, we're gaming the system. What do you think?
Well, you know, again, I think that's up to the discretion of the provider, right? So whether you use observation or not, that is 100% the discretion of the physician and the provider. And the guidance has always said, if you expect your patient to be in the organization for less than 48 hours, you should consider observation. Again, I'm not going to opine on what's right or wrong, but again, I think that's up to the interpretation of the physician, and they should use the guidance that's out there from CMS in making that determination and that decision.
We also found that there's an opportunity for enhancing your virtual care capabilities, that we do know of organizations that actually leverage that for these kind of patients, where you say, look, I'll co-manage the patient. And if there's any changes that occur that actually then with the transfer will actually increase the chances of survivability, then we can do that. But you're not abandoning them on their own. You're still just leveraging your virtual care. Have you seen similar things occur around the country as well?
Yeah, we're seeing more and more virtual care. There's telehealth, there's teleconsults, there's EICUs. There's a lot of modalities out there now that we can help these smaller facilities or even these rural facilities in managing patients that require certain types of care that aren't available in those areas that are available in more urban and larger academic medical centers and some of those other areas. So yeah, that's starting to take on some traction. I think there needs to be a little bit more development and a little bit more education and growing those businesses. I think the organizations that have been more successful in that have taken that on and are offering that and have seen the business model of that as well in a very successful progression.
So Aman, you know, I've also seen there are other academic medical centers that actually have a satellite ICU that's part of the emergency room. And the thought behind that is if they transfer a patient whom they believe has a very high risk of mortality within the first 48 hours, or even admit somebody that they believe is going to pass away in the first 48 hours, they actually place those patients in those satellite ICUs and also leverage it for short stay ICU visits, say for DKA or someone who is admitted through the emergency room with a high mortality risk as well. So I'm curious, and we're actually going to be observing that going into the future and what the data looks like for that. Well, that's all the time we have for this episode. I want to thank my colleague, Dr. Aman Sabharwal, in joining us, and he'll return for next episodes to continue our discussion. And if you'd like to contact Aman, we put his email address in the resource section in our podcast page. And if you have any additional questions pertaining to modern practice or simply want to send your comments, please contact me in our email at modernpracticepodcast.com. We posted a link in our resource sections. And please join me for other Modern Practice podcasts. Subscribe today, like us, or send us your comments. I'm Dr. Tom Villanueva. Thank you so much for listening.